This time, Hodgson's choice, Fulham's epic run to the UEFA Cup final. Welcome to By Far the Greatest Team, a football podcast where fans attempt the impossible to decide once and for all who is the greatest team of all time. My name's Graham Dunn. One Oxford United mention every 30 minutes, all your money back. And joining me as ever from the centre of our data matrix, it's Jamie Rooney. Hi, Jamie.
Graham, I'm going to have to start by giving you a yellow card, I think, because you introduced
us. You're going to tell me it's not the UEFA Cup final.
It was the very first ever Europa League tournament. The UEFA Cup finished in the season before, and this was the first time the Europa League came on. So, I mean, that's a yellow card, getting that wrong straight away.
I even thought that before. I was going to look it up just for, because I wrote it about 5 minutes ago. And I thought, well, was that actually? I've got a feeling it may not have been the UEFA Cup final. And we are joined by Fulham fan Stu Burgess. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Graham. I did notice that. Indiscretion there, but as the new boy, I thought I should just keep quiet and let you get on with it. But yes, Europa League first season.
Would there have been some sort of polite correcting of me when I came onto the? And of course, then there was the UEFA Cup campaign. Yes, in the Europa League.
I would have tried to, you know, do it politely, as you say. But yeah, let's get the right terminology. Fulham don't get too many European finals, so it's nice to kind of acknowledge what one we actually have got to.
For the League Cup, they've had countless sponsors of whom most people can't remember. Worthington Rumble as well. But of course, it's always the Milk Cup, because if you've only made one cup final ever.
I think it probably depends on your age, doesn't it? But the Milk Cup definitely is, it kind of resonates with me from the mid 80s. You had, was it Rumbelows and a Rumbelows. Few in there, but looking at some bits and pieces for this, I was kind of looking at some old results, and I reminded myself of the Anglo-Scottish Cup. But wasn't there in the early 70s the Watney Cup? Do you remember that one?
Yes.
The Watney Cup.
So what was the Watney Cup?
I have no idea. It just seemed to be a random selection of teams who played each other pre-season.
I think the Watney Cup was decided on the teams in the four league divisions, the teams that scored the most goals would go into a cup competition. So that kind of explains the random nature of it. So it wasn't based on league position. It was the number of goals that you scored. And it went across all four divisions in England. And I think the Watney Cup, I think that was the actual premise of the Watney Cup. It didn't last long. Watney was a beer company,
Watney,
wasn't it?
Watney
well?
was a beer.
Wasn't there an Anglo-Italian Cup?
Yeah.
Anglo-Italian Cup
back
as well.
In the day.
We've covered this, Swindon Town. We did an episode on Swindon Town,
and
they
went
to the final, and they actually went and won the first version of the Anglo-Italian League Cup, as it was called then, and then it kind of got rid of the league bit and just became the Anglo-Italian Cup, and Italian and English relationships have never been stronger.
As we're recording this, shortly after the unusual moment where Fulham have just lost to Chelsea, I was struck by, leading into this, I had no idea about this really quite poor record that Fulham have against Chelsea, which is sort of, I think, statistically in the Premiership, one of the worst matchups, if not the worst matchup there is.
Yeah, I had an indication that you were going to bring this up, which is kind of why I delved into the history books. And why I mentioned the Anglo-Scottish Cup, because actually Fulham are undefeated to Chelsea in the Anglo-Scottish Cup, having played them three times, won two and drawn once. But it's crazy how bad Fulham's record is. I mean, I knew that it was bad, but I'd say you mentioned it and I looked into it, and they've played 34 games in the Premier League against each other. of which Fulham have won 2 and drawn 11, and Chelsea have won 21. So out of 102 available points, Fulham have taken 17 and Chelsea have taken 74. So It's no wonder they're saying, can we play you every week?
Given where Chelsea have been and where Fulham have been over that period of time, it's not, you know, not surprising that Chelsea probably have the lion's share of it. But Fulham were a pretty good side during parts of this.
It's so marked, yeah. I mean, actually, Fulham did beat Chelsea last season 2-1 at home, but that was the first time they'd beaten them since 2006, I think. You just get some teams that kind of you just can't beat, and it's sod's law that it happens to be kind of the nearest yes. rivals.
We are going to talk about happier things than Fulham's impressive record against Chelsea. And we're going back to this, which was an incredible era under Roy Hodgson. I'd forgotten actually how established they were in what I like to call the John Collins, Collins John years, the period where you needed to have someone with the same name only in reverse for...
They never actually played in the same team, though.
I was really gutted to find that out.
John Collins had left prior to Collins John starting, which is a shame. I thought they could have extended his contract just to make that happen.
Do you think all of John Collins' kit got passed over to Collins John? Yeah, no, you always put surname first.
Could be, yeah. They actually went up to the Premier League in 2001. So their first season up was 2001. And the Europa League was 2010. So they've been, in the top flight for the best part of 10 seasons. Yeah, mainly under John Tigar and Chris Coleman, actually, who both sort of did pretty good jobs there. But Roy clearly kind of came in and made a big difference.
So Fulham were, did seem to have kind of established themselves as Premier League establishment by then.
Mohamed El Fayed, not necessarily everyone's cup of tea, but I mean, down Fulham, he still has legendary status because he kind of created the club, put it in a position where it is today. You know, he got Tigana, I think, had previously been manager of Monaco. You know, he was an established manager and he got players like Mal Bronk and Van der Sar played in goal for Fulham in the early years of the Premier League. Really? You know, and he was. You know, Dutch national keeper, international star. And so they could attract decent players. Lee Clark, who played for Newcastle for many years, he was there. So, yeah, they kind of established themselves pretty well in the top flight. And it was only actually kind of a couple of seasons before Hodgson joined that they had a sort of flirtations with relegation. Prior to that, they were kind of fairly well-established mid-table team.
It was slightly weird because it was Laurie Sanchez who was at that brief spell in charge and sort of kept Fulham up the previous year, though. I'm not sure entirely convincingly, but kept them up.
Yeah, I think if you spoke to a lot of Fulham fans, Chris Coleman had been the manager for about three or four seasons. He'd previously been a player at the club. Mm. And he'd unfortunately had to retire because he'd had a pretty serious car accident. So he was well liked and well respected. He took over from Tigana as kind of caretaker manager, did well and held the role for about 3 years. And then Al Fayed got rid of him towards the end of that 2006-2007 season, probably about April. And whilst Fulham weren't doing that well, they weren't in the relegation zone. I think they were on a bad run. Mm. And so I think quite a few people were a bit taken aback by the fact that Coleman got sacked. And then were further taken aback by the fact that they appointed Laurie Sanchez as a manager. He kept Fulham up, but I kind of think they'd have stayed up anyway. They weren't in any real danger. The following season, I think what most people expected happened was that they just didn't make any real progress.
And he seemed to do what quite a few managers do, where they go back to their... what they know, and Sanchez had just been in charge of Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
So suddenly you've got all these Northern Irish internationals.
He signed pretty much half the Northern Irish team, in fairness, didn't he? Chris Baird, David Healy, Aaron Hughes. Was it Sean Davis?
Yeah, of course.
So, literally lock, stock and barrel Northern Irish players. And again, no disrespect to the Northern Irish team, but I think there was a bit of head scratching when all this went on. I don't think anyone looks back with great fondness at Sanchez's tenure. But if you look at the players he signed, actually some of them went on to become real focal points for the successful Hodgson team, like Aaron Hughes, we've already mentioned, centre-back. Danny Murphy was signed by Sanchez. And Danny Murphy was, to my mind, the key player in that successful era. He was a great midfielder and, you know, he was a bit like a quarterback. He just used to spray the passes around. And he was signed by Sanchez, as was Konchesky, Paul Konchesky, the fullback. He predated Hodgson. So maybe we judged Sanchez a bit harshly at the time because he certainly, you know, made a contribution to the success going forward.
Jamie, you will. We'll talk about Danny Murphy in a bit, but as a Man United fan, you must have clear memories of Danny Murphy, who, as far as I could tell, every season scored a free kick for Liverpool against you.
Danny Murphy had a talent for amazing free kicks, but you know, she was absolutely right. I mean, Danny Murphy was. He's kind of like fundamental to the story we're going to talk through when we get through to the Europa League final. Mm. And I hadn't realised that Laurie Sanchez actually signed him because he came on loan, I think, from Tottenham originally. But yeah, I hadn't realised Sanchez had picked him up, which is quite key because he was absolutely one of the superstars. I mean, the core of this particular team we're getting to for the 2009-10 season is pretty special. But Murphy is a key part in that. A fantastic footballer, brilliant free kick specialist, but just a very intelligent footballer. A footballer I always appreciated because he could see the game a couple of seconds ahead of everyone else. And I think that's always a big advantage.
He had that ability that some players have to just sort of create time and space for himself. You know, there'd be sort of a lot of stuff going around him. And then by just literally kind of letting the ball run past him and moving on to it, he would seemingly open the game up and that would give him time to pick a pass out. Yeah, you know, I think certainly one of the top players Fulham have had in the modern era, if you like, since they hit the Premier League in 2001, I'd say.
Hodgson himself was a bit of a left field appointment by then because it sort of looked as though his career was meandering a bit by then.
I think it's, again, fair to say that my friends who are Fulham fans were slightly underwhelmed. If we were underwhelmed by Sanchez, we were equally underwhelmed by Hodgson. It was I mean, even then, and bless him, he's still going, even then I thought he was kind of past it. And he'd been all over the place, hadn't he? And most of it in Europe. He'd been manager. I think his only experience in Britain was at Blackburn, where he kind of had a couple of seasons and it was, you know, didn't really do a lot. So I think when he came in, everyone thought, really? Roy Hodgson? You know, where'd they get that idea from? And he didn't have an immediate impact. I think he came in just before Christmas and come sort of, you know, mid-March, we were still really deep in trouble. And there was a famous interview, I think, after we lost to Sunderland, where he was almost in tears on television, basically saying, you know, I'm sorry, I don't know why it's not working, kind of thing.
I was slightly surprised, actually. I suppose it's maybe if you only see him in the dugout now, how young, actually, relatively speaking, he looks in the dugout of the Fulham matches.
Yeah.
But in fact, he's been there because I think he took over Blackburn pretty much not long after Kenny Dalglish pit. You know, it was...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
They were a good side then, weren't they? Yeah, I think sort of mid-90s he was there. So it was, you know, a good 10 years or so until he came back. And he bounced around. I think he was manager of Finland.
I'm trying to find a complete list of Hodgson's clubs. It's quite difficult because there are so many. But Fulham is something like 16th, 17th. And you look at the clubs, you know, it goes Blackburn, back to Inter, Grasshoppers, Copenhagen, Udinese, UAE, Viking.
It's a real collection because he's actually managed four international teams as well in his time. Yeah. UAE, Finland, and then obviously famously England. I am a Roy Hodgson fan. I'm just going to put it out there. I have been for a while. I like his style and I think he's a gentleman. I had the privilege of meeting him once in Sicily. Yeah. A very humble restaurant in Cefalù. And I was like, I don't get starstruck very often, but I felt compelled just to go up and kind of wish him good luck for the Euros, which were being held in France in 2016. And he was a gentleman. He was so sweet. He was there with his wife. You know, he was happy to talk football. He was an absolute gentleman.
He's a hero at Fulham for what he achieved there. And you're right, Jay, I've never met him, but he just comes across as a gentleman, a genuinely decent man, doesn't he? So yeah, what's not to like, really?
One of those clubs he managed, the brilliantly named Viking Norway, Pangolin played for him there, I think, if I've got that right. Hodgson signs a, so obviously he joined, I think he takes over in December or start of January, and he brings in a bunch who make quite a difference, and Hangland is probably the one that stands out the most.
You know, alongside Danny Murphy, Hangland was one of the key players moving forward that kind of, you know, around which the team was built, and he came in that sort of winter transfer window. A couple of others he made in that period kind of did all right, but didn't really go on to do much. Paul Stalteri was a defender we got from Spurs who came in and did okay that season, but didn't seem to figure long term. And then we got Erik Nevland, who was another Scandinavian contact.
I just looked at the winter transfer window for this season when Hodgson's come in. And I like the kind of the synergy between Laurie Sanchez raiding Northern Ireland. And it's almost like Roy Hodgson has raided Scandinavia, an area he knows exceptionally well. Yeah, because you're right. Yeah. Hangland, Nevland, and also Jari Litmanen comes in as well.
Jari Litmanen.
Very famous for that. Yeah.
Jari Litmanen, who's a player I absolutely loved. I was thinking, I don't remember Jari Litmanen playing for Fulham. And when I look at these stats, it's not obvious he did play for Fulham. He was there.
I don't actually remember him playing for Fulham, so he wasn't even playing much.
I think he was a signing, but I don't think he ever made it in. But
Hodgson, he brought a few in, and it also he got lucky is probably the wrong word, but certainly Jimmy Bullard had been out injured for quite a lot of the Sanchez period, and he came back, and Brian McBride who was the centre forward, American centre forward, who was a real sort of folk hero down at Fulham. He'd been injured and he came back. So that run in, they kind of, the side was bolstered by Hodgson's signings, but also some players they already had who came back into the fold.
And it is incredible, isn't it? Because as you say, at that March point, they look doomed, don't they? I mean, I think they've only won once away all season. There's no goals in that team at all.
There was a point with three games left where at half time Fulham were technically relegated. They were two down to Man City and Birmingham were beating Liverpool, and had the season stopped at that point, Fulham couldn't have caught Birmingham or had those games stopped at that point. And then famously Fulham came back to beat Man City 3-2. Liverpool, I think, either drew or beat Birmingham. And then it was all back on. They won four of their last five matches that season, having won four of their first 33 matches. So that's quite a turnaround, really, isn't it? Yeah.
I absolutely vividly remember the Manchester City game. I remember it through the words of Jeff Stelling on Sky Soccer Saturday, because it just was one of those incredible stories where you're right, Stuart. I mean, because I've always had a soft spot for Fulham, and I was a bit sad that they were going to be leaving the Premier League, and it did seem an absolute nailed-on certainty based on everything that happened in the 34 games before that Man City game. And then I couldn't help but my ears get tuned in towards what was going on at the Etihad at that particular moment when Fulham were, you know, dead and buried, and then 20 minutes to go, there's a goal. And then suddenly, just from the distance that I am from being a Fulham fan, it felt quite incredible. How did it feel for you, Stuart, that 20 minutes where hope has been restored?
Yeah. Again, I think I'd probably, like you, I was watching it on Sky Sports and updates from Jeff Stelling. And Diamante Kamara scored, I think, in about the 93rd minute to kind of keep hope alive. And yeah, absolutely incredible, really. I think having said that, even at that point, I think most fans thought, okay, but we're still going to struggle. But Reading lost, I think, and I can't remember who else was down there. Birmingham, obviously.
Birmingham,
we were playing Birmingham the following week. So I think that, you know, kind of the penny started dropping. And if we kind of worked out, if we beat Birmingham the following week, that meant at worst, we'd still have a chance of staying up going into the last game. And I think 2 weeks before, any Fulham fan would have taken that. But Diamante Kamara, he scored some quite important goals for us that season. He come from West Brom, I think, where he'd been banging them in the Championship all over the place. And again, he was another Sanchez signing, actually. He signed him in the summer of 2007 season. And he did well for us that season.
I remember him really clearly as a player, despite actually when you look through his record over his time at Fulham, he didn't actually play that many games, he didn't score that many goals. And I think it might be the combination of both the crucialness of the goals, and of course he's one of those great breeds of strikers who have a specific celebration when they score their goal. I'm not quite sure what he was doing. He was like kind of sidewinder type thing there.
Yeah, it was some sort of weird movement, wasn't he? But he used to score quite good goals as well. That season we played Spurs at home and we were 3-1 down to Spurs and came back to draw 3-3. And again, it was a last minute equaliser from him and it was an overhead kick. And that was a great one. But that was... Berbatov played for Spurs in that game, and he was absolutely brilliant for the first hour. They were 3-1 up after an hour, and he clearly decided his work was done. And he literally went and sort of played right out on the touchline. He did everything but light up a cigar, and which kind of meant that for the last sort of half an hour, Fulham were playing against 10 men, and we managed to pull it back to 3-3. So it was... Yeah, of course he came to play for Fulham under Martin Jol a few years later, didn't he?
Berbatov. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Beautiful footballer, Dimitar Berbatov.
Yeah,
you're beating City, you're beating Birmingham, Stuart, and then it's almost like the football fixture gods have played into your hands because you're playing a Portsmouth team away who you've lost to earlier in the season, but they've got an eye on something a lot bigger the following weekend.
Yeah, they were in the cup final, weren't they? And you felt that there was the momentum there then because they'd won, Fulham had won 3 out of the previous 4 games. They'd beaten Birmingham, penultimate game of the season. So actually, going into that last game, we were out of the bottom 3. And if we won, that was it. We were going to be safe. But being a bit of a fatalist, Reading were playing away to Derby. Now, if you remember Derby, I think that season set all kinds of records. Of lack of points and victory and so on. They got 11 points in total that season. And actually, just as an aside, Fulham were the only Premier League team not to beat Derby that season. They drew with them twice. Every other team beat Derby at least once. Fulham drew with them twice. And the home game, which was 0-0, is still probably the worst game I've ever been to. It was just dreadful. But anyway, back to the original point. So Reading were away to Derby. Derby clearly had nothing to play for because they were already relegated and clearly were useless. And so Reading needed to make up a 7-goal deficit. So if Fulham won 1-0 and Reading won 7-0, Reading would actually pip us on goal difference. And they, if I remember rightly, Reading were 3-0 up after about 20 minutes. And everyone's going, what's happening, you know? Fortunately, they stopped at 4, and Danny Murphy, previously mentioned, a pivotal figure. I think Jimmy Bullard took the free kicks about 15 minutes to go, and Murphy rose like a salmon and headed it in the near post. So, and they stayed up, and it was, fantastic. Really, it was, you hear the term great escape, but that was an extraordinary escape, really.
They did look absolutely dead and buried. And I think, when you look at that team, the top scorer, 3 or 4 of them had a mighty 6 goals.
That sounds about right. I think McBride, maybe Clint Dempsey probably was one of those, I think, wasn't he? He was, again, a player we'll probably mention further on, but another great player. Through all the Hodgson era, Fulham were never big goal scorers. The season, the Great Escape season, again, I've been doing a little bit of research. These are figures I've just put I remember. But the Great Escape season, they scored 38 goals. And the following season, when they ended up finishing 7th, they scored 39 goals. So only one more goal.
This comes, of course, to the thing about Hodgson, is the football is... Or his training methods are very standardised and stylized. Everyone knows exactly what they're doing. I don't think you can necessarily say it reflects in sort of boring football because I don't think it translates that way necessarily. But it is definitely a team where everybody knows what they're doing, isn't it?
Absolutely. He's kind of proved that through his career that it's sort of a pragmatism. I've heard... that his coaching methods that are repetitive, but eventually you do these things out of habit because you're doing them all the time in training. And it kind of works, you know. It certainly worked at Fulham. He's done well at Palace. You know, West Brom, he did well. I think where, you know, he struggled at Liverpool, but I think that's a different type of club, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a bigger club. They have different expectations. They have bigger stars with bigger egos. And maybe Roy wasn't suited to manage in that way. But certainly the Fulham team moving on from the Great Escape, following year we finished seventh, highest ever finish. And he had a pretty settled 11, and everyone knew what they were doing. And he made some key signings again in the summer. Mark Schwarzer in goal, who was a fantastic keeper for Fulham all the way through his time there. He was a great stalwart. Hangeland, centre-back, alongside Aaron Hughes, who we mentioned already, who was signed by Sanchez. And then he also signed Bobby Zamora and Andy Johnson up front.
Mm.
Both good players, but neither of them prolific scorers.
Yeah, yeah, Bobby Zamora in particular. He got his big move quite early on with all his goals at Brighton, I think, and he went to Spurs and he was a big man, but he didn't really do anything. And then he was at West Ham for ages without doing loads. Mm. I mean,
yeah, Zamora's first season at Fulham, I think he only scored about three or four goals. Mm. He really didn't score many goals at all. But he contributed. He worked hard and he made life difficult for defenders. But his scoring record was pretty poor. And Andy Johnson scored more goals that season than Zamora. Mm. Clint Dempsey kind of chucked in with a few. But he got a bit of stick from the Fulham crowd, Zamora. That was when the chant that they came up with was, if the ball hits your head and you're sat in row Z, that's Zamora. To the tune of that's Amore, which the old Dean Martin. In fact, Dean Martin did quite well at Fulham in terms of chants because they had another one about Al Fayed to the tune of Bolare. Mm. So, Dean Martin, I don't know if he's claiming royalties, but he'd have done quite well out of it. But so Zamora's first season, he wasn't prolific. And I think there was a good chance he was going to leave and go to Hull at the end of that 2009 season. I think a deal had been lined up. For whatever reason, it didn't happen. And then the following season, he just seemed to click. Not many league goals, but he scored a ton in the Europa League. And he became a real talisman, I think, for Fulham. And, you know, he's universally popular there now. You kind of always got the impression that if he was on the pitch, he might not score, but he can make things happen. And yeah, he turned in, again, sort of, you know, the spine of the team, if you like. You've got Schwarzer, Hangeland, Murphy, Zamora out front. That was the spine around which the team was built, really.
Just a quick point on Zamora, and I things that probably not everyone always appreciates is that Zamora works incredibly hard as a footballer. Yeah. I mean, yeah, his job is to score goals, but if the team is winning and he's not scoring goals, there shouldn't be a problem. One of the things I really interested me that where I read when Bobby Zamora was talking about his game is that he actively said, I would work on my being a defensive forward, which I've never heard before in the realms of football. So clearly, you know, whether that's a Hodgson influence on him in terms of like just being drilled, kind of defend from the front. But it was quite interesting hearing him talk about being a defensive forward, which is something you never really, it's a position on football field that you never really hear much about.
Yeah. And, you know, say great work rate. No problem with his commitment at all. He was, a great player in that respect.
He was also, of course, obsessed by the number 25, wasn't he? That was his, so that had to be his shirt number.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Jamie, do you know why he
was? Well, yeah, the 25 was taken. I can't remember who had it. I think it might have been Aaron Hughes may have had it. And Zamora wanted it because he had this obsession with it. And I think he took the 52 shirt in his first season. And I think he spent the whole of that that season, just pleading with Simon Davis, please let me have the shirt, let me have the shirt. And you know, that tenacity absolutely worked, because the next season he is handed the 25 shirt. And that's the season where, you know, he goes on and has an incredible season. So clearly the effect of the number that's on his back relates to his performances. I don't think we should overlook one of the signings that also came in that particular season. I mean, when it comes to bang for your buck, I mean, does it get any better than getting Zoltán Gyerek free from West Brom? He probably had his best years of football in a football shirt at Fulham. He just seemed an extraordinary player that just found the right place at the right time.
He was an incredibly good player, and he was one of those, he was wiry, and he must have been really annoying to play against. You know, his legs snaking out and nicking the ball, and you know, and he, and again, he scored some pretty crucial goals going through that the Europa League campaign. He notched quite a few goals in that campaign. That was a great signing, and again, that was a Hodgson signing. And another one actually that he brought in that summer was Damien Duff. Like Zamora, he had a fantastic work rate, and he used to plough up and down. He was left-footed, but they used to play him on the right, and he cut in and then put the ball in with his left foot. I remember he scored against Newcastle, because we'd signed him from Newcastle, and he scored against Newcastle. And I think, I might have this wrong, but I think when he was at Newcastle, he played about 70 games, and he only scored one goal for them. But ironically, in his fourth game for Fulham, he managed to score against Newcastle. So that was quite good. Duff was a key member of that team, the Europa League team.
Going back to Zamora, because I've got about an hour's worth of Zamora material, I'm going to keep this going. So, I did. Sadly, I never got to the bottom of why he liked the 25 so much. But when you search, do a Bobby Zamora number 25 shirt, you just see loads of stories where, I don't know, this is completely lost to me, but you see he wears 25 wherever he goes. He's got 25 tattooed on his arm as well. So I think that's one of his tattoos for some reason. And I haven't had time to check this, but you know, I saw it in an article not that long ago, and I have no reason to disbelieve it. Bobby Zamora is also apparently one of only two players, Premier League players, who have scored penalties with their left and right foot. I don't know how anyone would get this.
I read that same article because I was going to mention that actually. And I'm assuming you know who the other player was.
So we're going to have to hand this over to Jamie. Do you know who the other player is?
Well, judging by the way you're laughing, Graham, I can only think it's going to be something quite unusual, but I can't.
Well, to add to the slight unusual nature of this, the player concerned played for Wolfsburg against Fulham in the quarterfinal of the Europa League that season. Yeah.
So is this going to be Edin Dzeko?
No, but good guess.
Yeah, it is a good guess, especially on the spot.
Right? Yeah.
I think you'd struggle to remember this guy. I've forgotten. Although he did.
If you're an Arsenal fan, you'd remember him, I think. Because didn't he score the winning goal in the League Cup against Arsenal?
He did, didn't he? Yes.
Yeah, when Birmingham beat them. Yeah.
So Obafemi Martins.
Martins,
Now
my other Bobby Zamora thing, though, this is the bit that I just can't really get my head around, that I've only just discovered this now. Do you know what he's doing now?
No idea.
So I had a little, so he is co-host of ITVX's The Great Fishing Adventure.
Is he?
two series of Bobby Zamora and a chap called Ali Hamadi, not someone I recognise, who I think is a fishing person, although I briefly thought it was Ali Hamadi, who was a former striker at Wimbledon, and I was trying to work out how this series had got pitched.
Well, I suppose as a footballer, you've got plenty of spare time, haven't you? So, you know, go and sit by the river.
Actually, it turns out that it's a great minefield. I've sort of drifted down this rabbit hole, but you can find... You know, I'd say a good 50% of Premier League footballers over the last 10 to 20 years posing with giant fishes that they've caught.
Really?
there's like an endless amount of them. I can even bring in my Oxford United reference that Oxford's very own Cameron Brannigan has been pictured fishing with some giant carp that he's caught along the way. It is just, it's extraordinary. They seem to be everywhere. So, because I was trying to think, oh, could I find some you know, famous fishermen of our time or fishing footballers? But there were too many to even choose from. But really, my favourite, Terry Hibbert, who after retiring or around his retirement in 2013, bought a carp fishing farm and has a whole fishing lake. So there's an entire... There are just too many fish.
Entire subculture.
But then, of course, that then drifts you into footballers who have these sidelines they're almost more famous for. And Jerry Francis was a massive pigeon fancier. I remember, God bless Five Live. I remember listening to that one time where they rang him up to talk about the, how they thought Tottenham were going to get on in that evening's game. And it was around the time the bird flu thing was going on. They're like, oh, Jerry, I know you like your pigeons. What do you make of this bird flu? And he found himself having to... So do we care what Jerry Francis thinks about bird flu?
I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of a bit of a bizarre pigeon fancying. You wouldn't have thought that would kind of go hand in hand with football, would you?
So Fulham do finish, to bring us out of my Bobby Zamora rabbit hole, Fulham do finish in seventh place in Roy Hodgson's first full season. And that then brings you on to this sort of incredible, remarkably quickly, because of course, Fulham are playing in the qualifying rounds, aren't they? And this is the start of what is like an endless season, isn't it?
They had to qualify. I think, you know, the first couple of games were in July. I remember they played Anker Perm in one of the initial qualifying rounds.
I think they played Vetra in Lithuania. And then we won quite comfortably. I think they won 6-0 over the two legs. And then they go to the middle of nowhere in Russia, where they get a bit of a hostile reception as well, where they try to get they're received on the team bus by a lot of fans that are trying to intimidate them. But I think the Fulham players found it quite funny, actually.
A season starting in July is sort of insane. And I think even by the time Fulham begin the kind of the qualifying stages, they're actually doing what a lot of teams do now, where they're sort of resting players or playing second string players in that qualifying stage. There's sort of no hint of what is to come, is there?
They kind of went sort of slightly deeper into the squad. And what was quite interesting was that some of the players that Hodgson signed, as you say, much more commonplace now, but they seem to play in the Europa League and not in the league. So like Stephen Kelly was a defender that they had in. They signed him from Birmingham. I think at one point he'd been in been at Spurs, but he played quite a few games in the Europa League. Jonathan Greening, who was another guy they got from West Ham, he was someone in the sort of support squad. Nevland was still there. He kind of made quite a few appearances. And they also, again, keeping up with Hodgson's raiding of Scandinavia, they signed Bjorn Helga Risa, who was the brother of John Arne Risa, who also played for Fulham later in his career. So they had a pretty broad squad.
Jonathan Greening, we always like mentioning Jonathan Greening because he's a man with European pedigree, isn't he, Jamie?
He's a very famous treble winner for Manchester United. He was part of that glorious 98.
Was he?
He had a Champions League medal along with, a Premier League medal. I don't think he had an FA Cup winner's medal. He had beautiful hair, and I think he always knew players with beautiful hair, and he certainly had that. And then later through his career, he developed a beautiful beard to go with that beautiful hair, and he was very much a brilliant throwback to the 1970s.
You know, I knew he was at Man United, but I don't associate him with the treble winners at all. I mean, did he actually play in that, you know?
No, he was in the squad, the match day squad. But yeah, I mean, he probably featured as much for Manchester United as Eric Nevland did. The Europa League definitely wasn't on the radar of the players because Danny Murphy, I read a quote that when he went to negotiate the bonuses for the season with Mohamed Al-Fayed, he famously said the Europa League took 30 seconds because they weren't interested. They never saw that they were going to gain anything financially from the Europa League. Yeah. So he was more focused on the Premier League.
Yeah. And it obviously crept up on the players. And I think it kind of crept up on the fans as well, really, because But it's the first time. Well, Fulham won, in inverted commas, the Intertoto Cup in about 2002 or something.
They did indeed.
This is good.
But they were one of three winners of the Intertoto Cup, and I must admit, at the time, it passed me by a little bit. And so I looked in, and I still couldn't quite understand how you could have three winners of a competition. But I think it enabled you to then play in the UEFA Cup or something. I think there was some sort of tag there. But when we hammered West Ham 5-0 a couple of weeks ago, which I swore I would mention because I've got a few West Ham friends who may hear this. When we hammered West Ham 5-0, they were singing it as this Champions of Europe, you'll never sing that. And so we were singing back, Inter Toto, we've won it one time. So there you go.
Fantastic.
But yeah, so it was an adventure, I think, for the supporters as much as anything. And I remember thinking, yeah, I'll go to a couple of the early games because we almost certainly won't progress. And then we got through the group, and it was sort of, you know, it's quite a some good teams in the group. Well, Roma were in the group, Basel, and CSKA Sofia. But they got through the group, and it all just seemed to kind of roll on from there, really. And one of the things I was doing, because obviously, you know, as I say, I've done a bit of some research into this, was it was interesting to see the players that played against Fulham in this run. I haven't looked at the group games, but in the last 16, Fulham played Shakhtar Donetsk, and we won 2-1 at home. And my son came in, he was, 9 or 10, and he still remembers that Shakhtar Donetsk team. He said they were absolutely brilliant, and we kind of stole the game a little bit, really. But Fernandinho was playing for Shakhtar Donetsk. As was current Fulham favourite, Willian.
He
was playing for Shakhtar Donetsk. And they were a good team. I mean, they really gave us a run for our money. And I think we had the home leg first. And I think most of us thought, you know, we're going to do well to get through here. But they managed to grind out a draw in Shakhtar. And I'm pretty sure Zamora scored the goal away there, I think.
Yeah, I think it was a pretty tasty goal. Shakhtar, we shouldn't pass it without saying they were actually the holders at this particular moment as well. They'd won UEFA Cup, Graham, the previous season. They were the defending champions, and also you're right, Stuart. I think of all the rounds, I mean, you can kind of look at the Juve game, which we'll get onto, which was just an incredible result. But you know, Juve at the time, as big as they were a bit of a kind of a wounded animal coming back from their scandal. I think the best team, and based on what I've read from the Fulham players who played in this campaign, they really eulogized over Shakhtar and their qualities. I think it was they went in a half time, and the players were talking amongst each other, saying, how can we get the ball from them? We can't get the ball from them. They keep the ball. They're just like playing these incredibly super precise triangles. And, you know, it was almost like Fulham couldn't believe they were leading a game against a team where they've never seen football played in such a strong and conquering fashion.
Yeah, they were a very, very good side. And, you know, like I say, I still remember kind of watching them with my jaw hanging down. And so my son, I think he still thinks they're probably the best team he's ever seen down there. So, got away with that. Can we go Juve?
Let's go Juve.
Obviously lost away 3-1. And this is probably one of, if not the most famous game in Fulham's history, certainly up there. I missed it because I was in Frankfurt on business with a mutual friend of ours, Graham, Mr. Sean. And it was one of these trips. I couldn't rearrange it. It was kind of fixed in the diary. Mm. And obviously when we put the trip in, I had no expectation that Fulham were going to be still in the Europa League. So 3-1 down, and there was no... I don't know if there were many sports bars in Frankfurt at the time. Certainly we couldn't locate one. If we had located one, I very much doubt whether they'd be showing Fulham versus Juventus, because probably the other German teams.
Or that Sean would have got you there.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that Sean probably wouldn't have got me there. And also his penchant for the real ale would took us in that direction rather than in the football direction. Of course, those were in the days when a mobile phone was a phone rather than access to the internet and all this kind of stuff. So I had no way of keeping up with the game, other than the fact that my son, wife and daughter were all there. And I got a text after a minute saying we're 1-0 down, which made it 4-1 on aggregate. And I thought, fine, in which case, you know, I'd like to be there, but it's not one of these things I'm going to regret for the rest of my life. We're going to go out. It'll be fine. And then, of course, it all went wango, didn't it? And you can tell me, Jamie, it was the centre-back got sent off, didn't he? Was it Canna?
Yeah.
Began with a C. Cannavaro.
Yeah.
He got sent off. It all just... Well, I think Zamora had basically been... just got under his skin, was my impression.
Yeah, yeah. Everything I've read about it was that Zamora had just had this unbelievable first 20 minutes or so against him and just run him ragged.
Yeah, and yeah, I think before the game, Zamora was making comments about, he's passed it, this fella, and I'm going to sort him out. And he obviously kind of got into his head. And Zamora scored after about 10 minutes to make it 1-1. Mm. And then Cannavaro got sent off. And then I think Gira got one just before half time. And all I knew about this was I was getting texts from my son saying, you know, well, you know, they're down to 10. And I'm sitting there with a real ale enthusiast who's, you know, commenting about the fruitiness of the Dunkless beer. And I'm good. And then. Gira, I think, scored two, didn't he? Gira got a penalty. And then Dempsey scored an absolute corker in the 82nd minute, kind of lofted it into the far corner.
It's an incredible goal. That chip is just... Yeah. When you watch, there's one particular angle you watch it from where you can sort of... You can see he knows exactly what he's going to do as he's going away the wrong direction goal. Yeah. You can see he's got in his mind to do it. You know, he's not even looking really as he's doing it. Just in from the moment he chips it, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I have a bit of a man crush on Clint Dempsey. I did then, and I think I still do now. But the goal is, I mean, you're right, Graham. He is his presence. I mean, his first touch takes him to a space where he's already ahead of everyone else. Mm. And then he, as he's adjusting his body to get the spin to get his foot connecting with the ball, he's upright, he's strong, you know, his head's up. He already knows what he's going to do. And it's an absolute beautiful, beautiful goal. It really is. From an incredibly brilliant and volatile footballer who I do have a bit of a man crush on.
I was actually going to say, we haven't spoken a great deal about Dempsey, and he was a great player. And he grew through that Hodgson era, I think, as I mentioned earlier. He wasn't always an automatic starter. And him and Gira seem to sort of be competing for a similar position. But he'd been there, actually. He predated Sanchez. He was actually a Chris Coleman signing.
Oh, wow.
Clinton Dempsey. He'd been there since about 2007. And, quality player. Just had the ability, as you say, create space for himself, strong on the ball, and had a nose for goal. And, a great... And they still... You know a player is popular when they still sing about him. There's still a Clint Dempsey song, which they break into at Fulham occasionally, to the tune of Sloop John B, as so many football songs are.
That's fantastic. What a song. What a brilliant song to have a chant at.
It's sort of one of those things which sort of marks that Hodgson reign, is actually a number of times it looks like they're dead and buried. So that, just in the same way as when they're 2-0 against City, it does seem all over. And, you know, you can imagine the team talk beforehand is, okay, we need to get one early, we get ourselves back in, get a foothold. If we can be 1-0 up, 1-0 half-time, we can take it deep or something. Mm. 2 minutes later, you're a goal down. It's kind of, Yeah. Still somehow.
Going back to Hodgson's kind of managerial style, I mean, he obviously wasn't a you know, a teacup thrower. You can imagine him being quite authoritative, but I think he probably, you know, you manage, you know, good managers manage bad situations well, don't they? And you're right, the amount of times that the team looked like they were dead and buried and got themselves out of trouble, I think is testament to his management style. And also the fact you had some experienced, cool-headed players on the pitch, like Danny Murphy, like Hangeland, like Schwarzer in goal, and these and Aaron Hughes as well. Actually, was kind of one of the elder statesmen. And they would bring a kind of maturity and so on, and a no, don't panic approach, I think. Because it was, say, we're rewinding slightly to sort of the team prior to this, the Great Escape team. And who Hodgson let go. And I think it's indicative of the sort of players he likes and the sort of players he doesn't. Because Jimmy Bullard was a big, you know, very popular player down at Fulham, extrovert and so on. But Hodgson let him go quite early on. And you kind of think about it, Jimmy Bullard is not Hodgson's type of player, is he? Yeah. He's the kid at the back of the class who's sort of flicking pellets around. And you can imagine him not listening very closely. And so regardless of how talented he was, and he clearly was a great talent, I can imagine Hodgson getting slightly frustrated with Jimmy Bullard and therefore moving him on. Yeah. But yeah, you know, sorry, I can't remember where we started on that. But yeah, oh yeah, the ability to sort of just kind of get back into games. Yeah, they definitely had that. And I think the crowd sensed that as well, because there was always a feeling in that period that if we went behind to someone, we were still in it. There was still a way back. Whereas in other eras, it's if you go behind, you think, oh, that's all over then, you know.
I think it's really one of the notable things about that cup run is they've managed in particular to create some really electric atmospheres down at Craven Cottage, which is usually known as everyone's favourite away ground to go to. Yes. You know, you've got pubs there, it's a lovely, you know, people, there's not anybody who doesn't like going to down to Craven Cottage. So they managed to achieve that against that backdrop and with, you know, one of the nicest men around, Diddy David Hamilton, doing the pre-match warm-up.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant.
Diddy David. Yeah, I'd forgotten he was there. He disappeared very quickly. There was no announcement that he was going. He just didn't come back. I think it was when the season they got relegated, actually. But there can't be many football teams who have a stadium announcer of that high profile.
I remember the first time I went to Fulham away, and I loved it. It must have been when Jean Tigano was in charge. I think it was an FA Cup game just before Fulham got promoted into the Premier League. So it must have been around 2000, 2001. I think, and it was a time where I think it's the Hammersmith end. It was completely open. There was no cover over the top. And I remember hearing the announcer, and I'm like thinking, that sounds just like David Hamilton. How uncanny is that? And I'm like saying to my mates, that sounds like David Hamilton, doesn't it? And we're like, yeah, it does. And it wasn't until I went back a few years later, I realized actually it was David Hamilton. He was the announcer, for 18 seasons, I think. It's like this kind of weird connection, having him do the announcements.
That would have been great, though, if you had old DJs turning up at all these old football grounds, you know.
Alan Fluff Freeman.
Reading the line out, you know. And in goal today, it's... that's an idea.
You could do it to the old countdown, the old pop pickers.
Yeah. That is definitely... Yeah. Why hasn't someone done that? That must be done.
Yeah, excellent.
Weirdly, I had the same thing, same sort of experience. I went to see one of the first times I saw Fulham, one of the more recent times was Watford away, and I was in the Watford end and was absolutely staggered to see David Hamilton there. But the other weird thing about that, and this comes back to places where managers are heroes in one particular place, but are, you know, whatever else is going on in their world.
And
I think Fulham went up that year as well. Watford definitely went up. It's on the Championship and the second tier or whatever it was then. I can't remember who was managing Fulham at the time, but Watford were managed by Graham Taylor, who was kind of restoring his reputation after the England debacle. So Graham Tan came out, walked out across the pitch, and like was being greeted by the "We're not worthy" from the Watford fans. I was stood there going, "Oh, John, he's the manager. Come on, how's he got a job?" You know, all we can remember was alternative head. So there was probably only Watford and only Villa fans would give him that kind of treatment at that stage. Anywhere else, he'd be laughed at.
But he was at Watford initially, wasn't he? That's where he started, and he took them up through all four divisions. And so I guess that's why he's held in that esteem. But it's odd, isn't it? Some managers work at some clubs, but not others. And, you know, it seems to be the same for players as well, doesn't it? I mean, he's disproved this theory now, but Eddie Howe did really well at Bournemouth, went to Burnley, and it didn't work out, and he went back to Bournemouth and did really well again. So, and he's now doing well at Newcastle, so that disproves that theory.
Leading on from kind of David Hamilton, brilliantly dispatched Juventus, you know, this massive football team. I was fortunate enough, Stuart, to catch it on television, and I remember jumping all over the place with glee to see this amazing turnaround. And then we've got David Hamilton, our brilliant announcer, and they get to the quarterfinal and they face Werder Bremen, who we should point out are the actual Bundesliga champion. Now, that seems weird now because Bayern Munich win it all of the time, but there was a period of time not so long ago where Bayern Munich didn't win the Bundesliga and Werder Bremen were the champions at that particular moment. And you know it's getting serious now with the Europa League campaign, because suddenly the cameras pan into the stadium and the celebrity fan is being shown. And who would you want other than former Prime Minister Hugh Grant supporting your team?
He still goes, doesn't he, in fairness to him. He gets down there a bit. As does Emily Maitlis. She's a Fulham fan.
Oh, she's a Fulham fan.
Yeah.
He's reading that,
And the who's the fella? Neil Dudgeon, who plays
Barnaby.
Midsummer Murders.
Barnaby. Oh, this is good.
Wow. He's a Fulham fan.
Another one. Richard Osman's a big Fulham fan. He's a bit like you, Graham. Yeah, he's a bit like you because he never fails to try to get a Fulham reference on every programme he's on.
Every podcast, I have to say, every time I ever...
I've never seen Richard Osman there, in fairness, and you'd think he'd be quite easy to spot, wouldn't you? And there's another guy who I think is a TV chef that I'm struggling to remember his name, but he's definitely... so you get a few celebrities down there.
I have to point out, Oxford's big celebrity fan is Timmy Mallett. And earlier this season, Michaela Strachan came along as well. So we had two-thirds of the Real Wild, Really Wild show there. Now that is, you know, fantastic. Who else could claim that? That quarter-final side then, that's Werder Bremen. Any stars of that or the Juventus side?
Was it Wolfsburg? I thought it was Wolfsburg rather than
Wolfsburg. Oh, God, yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you for correcting me, Stuart. It was Wolfsburg, who were the German champions. Werder Bremen were the team that lost in the final the previous year to Shakhtar. So I'm getting my German W teams mixed up. Thank you for correcting me, Stuart.
Easily done. And they both play in green, don't they? I think Werder Bremen. Wolfsburg certainly do. Edin Dzeko, as Jamie previously mentioned, he played for Wolfsburg in that. And the previously mentioned Obafemi Martins also played for Wolfsburg. I remember this game as being actually one of the Fulham dominated the home fixture. Bobby Zamora scored, Damien Duff scored. We were sort of pretty comfortable 2-0 up, and then they nicked one back right at the end to make it 2-1, which kind of added a bit of edge to the. To the return leg, and in fact, also playing for Wolfsburg was a guy who went on to play for Fulham under Felix McGath. And McGath wasn't manager of Wolfsburg at this point, but he subsequently took over, and so this guy obviously paid on it. Ashkan Dzagha, which unless you're a diehard Fulham fan, you probably would never have heard of him.
There's obviously a chance for Ashkan Dzagha.
Yes. Well, no, not anymore. And he actually, in the brief but unforgettable reign of Felix McGath, Dzagha seemed to be the one player that actually improved under McGath. So maybe there was some sort of thing there. But no, he wasn't manager of Wolfsburg at this point. So I won the first leg 2-1, but then Bobby Zamora scored after a minute of the away leg. to put us 3-1 up. And that seemed to be it. They kind of held on from there. So I don't really remember much about that one. But
the semi-finals against Hamburg, but of course there's this added twist to it all, that the final itself is going to be in Hamburg.
You got the impression that Hamburg kind of felt that they were it was their destiny to get there. And so it was quite nice to sort of, you know, disillusion them of that. And they went one up in it was 0-0 the first leg away.
Yeah.
We held them 0-0. And then the second leg they went a goal up. It was is it Stefan Petrich?
Yes.
Yeah.
Who subsequently went on to play for Fulham. Yeah. He went on to play for Fulham. I think that kind of took the wind out of everyone's sails a bit. And, you know, there was a sort of, you know, you said about the atmosphere was great. I think the atmosphere was very tense at that point. Because having got this far, I don't think anyone could actually believe we'd got this far. But having got this far, it then became crucial that we got to the final, you know. You did semi-finalists. Can you remember who the defeated semi-finalists were in the other semi-final of this tournament?
Not a hope.
Liverpool.
Oh, you're kidding.
Which I'd completely forgotten, but Liverpool lost to Atletico Madrid in the other semi, so it could have been an all-English final had Liverpool won.
All-English finals weren't a thing. It's a bit sort of become, sort of got used to it
You had the Chelsea, Manchester United, they played in the Champions League final in 2008, I think it was. Which is the first Champions League, and I think Arsenal and Chelsea played off in the final as well. Yeah, but you're right, Graham. Now it seems to be commonplace where you get two English teams in the final. There's a couple of things in this whole Hamburg game, though, quite fascinating that we probably shouldn't brush over. I mean, you mentioned the Petrich goal. I mean, the free kick, if you haven't seen it, Graham, go and look at it. I think it's what youngsters call knuckleball. It's the invention of knuckleball, where you kind of do that Cristiano Ronaldo kick through the ball with very little kind of follow through, minimizing the spin on the ball. So it has that ridiculous dip. And then Petrich does have that ridiculous dip. It looks, you know, when you watch it on television pictures, it looks like it's going over until the very last second and almost like darts in. I mean, there's a lot of great goals in this whole campaign. Bobby Zamora scores a great goal. I think in the Juve or Shakhtar, maybe Shakhtar, he scores a wonderful goal.
Shakhtar, I think that was Shakhtar, actually.
Yeah, and then you've got Zamora, who actually picks up an injury during this season. And there's a few injuries as well. Dempsey's come back from injury. Zamora isn't looking likely to play in the semi-final against Hamburg, but he is. And Dempsey has the most incredible reaction. He, I don't know if you know this, Stuart, but he's been dropped from the team and he ends up punching a window at Craven Cottage. By all accounts, severed the window, thick glass window, and then tendons are actually in his arm. So if you watch him in the final, when he comes on in the final, he's actually wearing a sleeve on his arm. And he's wearing that because in his disappointment of not being selected for the game against Hamburg, he's put his hand right through a window, which is just another level of just man crush love for how passionate this guy is.
And he must have been disappointed because he had played very well. But Zamora, like I say, was a bit of a talisman there. And so I can kind of understand why. And he was like Roy's man as well, Zamora.
I've just been watching that free kick. That's unbelievable, isn't it? That's absolutely ludicrous. Always great when you make a keeper look stupid as well. Your keeper's obviously going both ways at the same time.
And it was the sort of goal I remember quite distinctly where it just sucked all the energy out of the crowd. Mm. Everyone's shoulders dropped. And it was just like, oh, blimey, you know, what was that? And from being confident and thinking, okay, 0-0 away, we're at home, you're 1-0 down to a wonder goal. And I think, you know, nerves began to get a bit frayed at that point.
Just going back to the away game, though, we had this before in a previous podcast when we talked about Inter Milan, Jose Mourinho's
trouble winning Inter Milan.
When Barcelona, Pep Guardiola, had to go to Milan to play, they had to travel by bus, not the conventional plane. And Fulham also had to travel to Hamburg for that game by bus.
Yeah.
That's because of a certain volcano had erupted and caused the Europe.
Yeah.
The Icelandic volcano. I'm going to embarrass myself for pronunciation. The Ijafjallajökull, I think it's pronounced.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you on that. If you say that's how it goes. It was like, you know, a 20-hour or 20-plus bus journey to the game, which, you know, and to battle out for a nil-nil. I mean, you know, that's quite impressive under those kind of circumstances. Although both me and Stu have spent 20 hours trying to get somewhere with the aforementioned Sean Buck, but that's another story.
Well, yeah, because I was at an air show in Geneva when that volcano went up, and there was some, you know, kind of concern about being able to get back. But yeah, the skies were clear of aircraft for quite a few days, weren't they? Whilst that went on. Yeah, and Hamburg, so my list of players who played against us, Hamburg had a good side. They had, Van Nistelrooy was up front for them, post-Man United. Yeah. And Zé Roberto, the ex-Brazilian sort of stalwart central midfielder, he played for them as well. So they were a good side. And like I say, I think you got the impression they felt it was their destiny to play in the final. Mm. But Fulham came back in the second half, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite late on, isn't it? It's like, I think it's about 70 minutes or something when Simon Davis, a very super reliable, hard-working player.
I guess, a player we barely mentioned, but he'd been there pre-Hodgson. He was another Chris Coleman signing. And yet, kind of not dissimilar to Damien Duff, actually. Worked hard, put the yardage in, but also very talented and kind of, you know, popped up with the odd goal. But interestingly, and without giving anything away, he scores in the semi-final and the final of this tournament. Mm. And he didn't score any other goals all season. They were the only two goals he scored. So he didn't score in the league. He just scored in the semi-final and the final. Yeah, he was a good player. And again, he was you know, a very popular player down at Craven Cottage. So yeah, he got one and Zoltán Gyökér got the other in the Hamburg game.
As you say, that completely goes against the script of Hamburg getting to the final. For Fulham, it means, you know, having started 10 months previous, and in, I think it's their 19th game in that cup run, that they end up in the final of the Europa League.
Well, the 19 games is incredible. I mean, as Paul said before, that's half a Premier League season. So they played a Premier League season, plus they played another half in European competition over a 10-month period, and 20,000 miles travelled. And that doesn't include the tour to Australia as well, incredibly. I looked it up because I thought this must be the most that any team has ever played getting to a final in Europe. And it is, but they share it, Fulham, with Marseille, who got to the Europa League final in, I think, 2018, and also lost to Atletico Madrid. And also, quite recently, Feyenoord got to the UEFA Conference League final a couple of years ago, where they also lost in the final to Roma. So 19 games is incredible. I thought Fulham would have been head and shoulders on their own with that, but they share that record. And I think that's just down to the fact that European football, obviously, is the appetite is growing bigger and bigger in terms of having group stages in the tournaments lesser than the Champions League. But 19 games is incredible.
And a test of, you know, what was not that deep a squad. You know, they had decent players outside the first 11, but, you know, that's certainly not the sort of level of squads that you see these days.
In the Premier League, they still finished, I think they finished mid-table, from memory. I haven't got it in front of me here, but I think they finished mid-table. So they had a fair season 12th. In the Premier League. 12th. Okay, cool.
Yeah. I think that kind of, the Premier League, they were never outside the sort of middle three or four positions. And I think that kind of helped because it meant you didn't have to worry too much about the Premier League. You know, they just kind of plodded along, getting enough results to make sure they were reasonably comfortable. Once again, scoring 39 goals. So, once again, you know.
That's brilliant.
Prolific they weren't.
I mean, that's really something, isn't it? Two half seasons as manager, Roy Hodgson, and he's got them scoring in that
Yeah, 38-39.
I mean, he'd probably argue if you'd given him a full season in that year before, he'd have got them to 39. Yeah. He'd got them up from 38. That was only because he did half a year then.
Yeah, he'd have edged up that extra goal. Yeah, definitely.
The final again is a bit is another sort of epic battle, and Atletico Madrid obviously. Again, a number of famous faces in that mm-hmm. team, aren't there?
Yeah, De Gea was the goalkeeper who obviously went on to Man United. I mean, he must have been quite young then. I don't know how old he is.
Yeah, I think he was 19 or 20. He was very young.
Yeah. Reyes, the old Arsenal player, who sadly no longer with us, but he was in that Atletico side. And Aguero, Sergio Aguero, before he went to Man City, was up front.
All those free scoring players. Who'd have thought it'd be Diego Forlan who'd get two goals?
Yeah, and he was at United, wasn't he?
Yeah,
he was. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, what were your thoughts on him, Jamie? Was he, you know, was he popular at Old Trafford? Or
he was popular. He was liked because similar to what you talked about, Bobby Zamora, he worked incredibly hard and tasked him for the team. He had a bit of a noose around his head, though, because I think it took him about 28, 29 games before he scored his first goal for United.
Right.
But once that was done, he actually went on and scored some important goals. I remember a couple of goals he scored at Anfield were very important. And we shouldn't forget, I mean, we've covered this in the Ghana podcast we did, Graham, where Forlan plays in that incredible quarterfinal with Uruguay. Forlan goes on and wins the best player in the 2010 World Cup. So Fulham could argue that they're facing a Diego Forlan who's in the absolute prime of his career at this particular point.
I think it is testament to that side. I mean, again, Fulham will go behind relatively early in that game to Forlan. And the side that plays in that final is kind of the same established side. And it's got all those linchpin players who you think of as playing all the games, you know, Murphy and the Pangland and Hughes and Zamora, but by then the injuries are really, it's taking its toll, isn't it? There's a sort of feel that game is probably a game too far for them in terms of a kind of injury. Zamora was obviously he missed the previous three games, I think, and is only just able to play in that. I mean, you get to that stage of a season normally you're sort of being patched up, but if that has started, you know, and actually quite a lot of those players did play in the July, you know, in the July starting game,
yeah. I think you're probably being a bit generous there, Graham. I think that, you know, whether that had that much of an impact, I don't know. I think the fact that they got there, you look at who was playing for Atletico Madrid, clearly they were favourites. I think Fulham put up a pretty good show. And, yeah, Zamora wasn't fully fit. Clint Dempsey, obviously, we've subsequently learned, sort of injured himself. But he was on the bench. But I think most of the rest of the team were kind of the normal starting 11. I mean, one player we haven't mentioned who was pretty important throughout that season was Dixon Etuhu, who was the centre midfield with Danny Murphy. And he was the sort of, you know, the solid ball-winning centre, you know, and he was a big unit, Dixon Etuhu. You wouldn't have wanted to take him on. And he allowed Murphy to sort of, you know, play by taking on the more defensive roles. And he was pretty important.
So Fulham gets so close. It goes, they get it to extra time. They almost get it to penalties and drag it on the way. And it's a harsh way to lose it in the end with about 5 minutes to go when Fulham gets that second.
Yeah. I was round at my friend's house, Dave, and quite a few of us are gathered around there. Didn't have the available funds to go to Hamburg. But so there were a lot of us there. And you kind of get to, like, you know, 115 minutes and you're thinking, it's penalties. You know, it's got to be penalties. And then who knows? And then Forlan pops up with another one. So, yeah, disappointing. But you look at the achievement of the season and it was magnificent, really. You know, it's Fulham. You know, it's not Liverpool, it's not Man United, it's Fulham, and they got all the way through, and it was absolutely brilliant. The whole experience was great.
Having seen David De Gea in many penalty shootouts over the last 10 years, I feel pretty comfortable and confident saying that if it had gone to penalties, Fulham would have won quite comfortably because he just doesn't get anywhere near any of them.
It's true, actually. He doesn't seem to be particularly good in penalty shootouts, does he? But Schwartz, Mark Schwartzer, obviously was in goal for Fulham, and he'd played for Middlesbrough when they lost the UEFA Cup final Sevilla in 2006.
Doesn't Schwartzer make a penalty save against Roma in the group stage as well? A brilliant save.
Yes, he did. And he was a cracking keeper, and he seemed to be one of those sort of fairly unflappable guys. So I'd have quite fancied him in a penalty shootout, actually, the Schwartz. I saw him in Sainsbury's in Cobham. I bumped into Mark Schwartz in Sainsbury's in Cobham. And unusually, I went over and asked if I could shake his hand. And he said yes. Nice fella. Yeah.
What I like is Roy's last roll of the dice is, you know, there's only a couple of minutes to go, and, you know, maybe really you haven't got many resources left to throw on it. What do you do? Throw on a treble winning Jonathan Greening comes up on the 118th minute.
Maybe he was hoping that his marvellous hair and beard would distract the Spanish opposition, who like a good beard, I think, the Spaniards, don't they? So maybe that was the thinking.
To some extent, Fulham are a bit of a victim of their own success then, because having that Europa League run sort of shines a light on the job that Hodgson is doing. I mean, if Fulham had been finishing 7th, 8th, it's probably not going to be enough to tempt Liverpool to come. I'm calling, as we said before, he'd sort of been, the big clubs, I think, had sort of thought it wasn't for him. But obviously the downside then is that Hodgson leaves relatively, you know, after a relatively short stint.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think he left in the July, didn't he? So literally sort of 2 months after this. And he was only in charge at Fulham for 2 full seasons. He had the half season when they stayed up, and then the following 2 seasons. So, I don't know. I mean, you know, if he'd stayed at Fulham, would we have gone on to greater glory? I don't know, really. I kind of suspect that would have been the peak anyway. Possibly the decline that happened a couple of years later might not have happened, because I think, you know, he'd have probably been a safer pair of hands than some of the guys that followed him. He only took one player with him from Fulham to Liverpool, which was Paul Konchesky.
Of course, he was the only one that went.
And I meant to look, actually, at who was left back for Fulham at the time, because clearly whoever it was, Roy didn't fancy him and thought Konchesky would be a better bet. Maybe it was a bit of a maverick in the mould of Jimmy Bullard. Who knows?
I mean, it is interesting when you look at that. I think that's probably what, when you look at that Fulham side, a lot of those players had their best moments under certainly Zamora, and he certainly had this tried and tested group that he was able to get. I'm not sure Clint Dempsey ever, he got his move to Spurs afterwards, but he
And that was a shame, because he was only there for a season at Spurs and then he went back to the States, and I'm not sure what happened there, but it was a shame to lose him, because he wasn't an old player at that point. He was probably 26, 27. And I think, being honest, if you support Fulham, you kind of expect your better players to move on. And you don't mind if they move on and do better and they move on to bigger clubs. And so he'd moved on to a bigger club, but he didn't really do much there. And then he went back to the States, and you kind of think, well, couldn't we have just kept hold of him? Spurs ram-raided us that summer. They took him and they took Moussa Dembélé, who wasn't in this team, but he came the following season, and he was a cracking player, actually. But I think certainly, getting back to your point, Graham, this probably, you know, for Simon Davis, Zoltán Gyökér, Dempsey, Hengel and Hughes, this probably would have been the pinnacle for them. Danny Murphy, I can't remember, he must have won stuff at Liverpool. He always seemed to be a little bit in and out of the side at Liverpool. So
I think wasn't he at Spurs afterwards as well? And I'm not sure he ever.
Yeah,
he obviously played at he played big games and contributing stuff, but it wasn't the kind of heyday of either side. And I think there's an element to which that was, he could be the fulcrum of that team. I think he was able to play the role he kind of wanted to.
Yeah, agreed. He was never going to be the main man at Liverpool, but he certainly, I think, was the main man at Fulham, or one of the main men at Fulham.
At least that fall from grace enabled Fulham to have a brief spell with Felix Magath as manager, and there's nothing.
Yeah, they were dark days. It all started going a bit weird. After this, really, Hodgson left, Mark Hughes came in for a season. And actually did well, and he changed the style a bit. We played a bit more on the front foot. He bought Moussa Dembélé in, was probably his major contribution. He was a cracking player, actually. You know, he was another one who always seemed to have time on the ball, big strong unit. But then Hughes left after one season. Kind of got the impression that he felt he was too big for the club, and I think he kind of left in anticipation that a bigger team would come in for him. So it was quite satisfying that he ended up at QPR and then Stoke, and then most recently Bradford City. There you go. But then after him is where it all started getting weird. Martin Joel came in. The rot set in under Joel. And then Alfayed sold the club, which in the long term has not been a bad thing, but in the short term added to the sort of disruption and so on. And then we went through René Meulensteen. Became manager briefly, whose daughter is now one of the commentators on Sky Sports. And she's very good, actually. I can't remember what her first name is, but she's very good.
Pia.
And he got the Pia Meulensteen, she's really good. And then Magath came in with his infamous stories about rubbing cheese into groin strains and stuff. And it just... He was a very strange fella, and he looked like the guy out of Danger Mouse, didn't he? He looked like Danger Mouse's mate, Penfold.
Yeah, Penfold,
And then we got relegated, and it took 5 or 6 seasons to get back again.
Oh, good stuff. Right. Well, we should, after this trip down memory lane, we should get to the stage of ranking this team. Mm-hmm. We have 5 categories of greatness, from all-time greats right at the top, down to true greats, to touch of greatness, our middle category, edge of greatness, and then for this one. Jamie, do you want to kick us off on this?
Yeah, troubling times for me on this one, because there's no secret. I am a closet Fulham fan, and if I hadn't been so ingrained as a Manchester United fan by the time I reached adulthood, I think I could have been a regular visitor to the cottage. And I love this team. And I see this as a collection of players all coming together at the perfect time with the perfect coach in the perfect moment. It's almost like the kind of the pinnacle of so many of these players' career. And I think when you look back in terms of what they said, I think they feel that way as well. And, you know, you've got the added factor of Diddy David Hamilton, and you've got the celebrity fan base of Hugh Grant. I looked at where we ranked teams previously, and I want to go true greats on this one, but I look at what we've got in our buckets already, and I think the context of the story, getting to the finals, brilliant. The number of games, Jonathan Green in face furniture aside, I still think they rank in the edge of greatness bracket, which I feel mean doing that. But that puts them in there with Hamburg, Kevin Keegan's Hamburg. That puts them in there with the amazing Millonarios, the Pirate League in Colombia. And that puts them in there with Tottenham Hotspurs, the near treble winning team of 87-88. I'm going to start off for edge of greatness, and I will be open to changing my mind.
So, Stu, edge of greatness is sort of category 4 in our 5 categories. Where would you go with this side?
I'm obviously biased. I'm tempted to go true greats. but... in respect to you boys and your, you know, kind of obviously highly honed judging technique, I suspect that true greats is kind of overstating it a bit. So I will go touch of greatness, because I think there were moments of greatness. You know, the Dempsey winner against Juventus. Yeah. Zamora just, you know, generally being this talisman up front, Schwarzer in goal. You know, there were a lot of big players in that team who stood up to be counted, and the likes of Duff and Davies and, you know, people who put a lot of graft into it. So I think Touch of Greatness is me being, you know, reining my neck in a little bit, but I think that's probably a fair assessment.
I think I thought I was going to go for Edge of Greatness. I thought I could make the case that, well, you know, if they've won the UEFA Cup,
yeah.
the Europa League,
yes,
if they won the Europa League, yeah. Then that, but, and because we've put so many teams in Touch of Greatness, we feel we should mix it up. But then I just love Danny Murphy and I love Clint Dempsey as footballers. I don't know what it is about them. And for those two, for Clint Dempsey alone, I think they have to be Touch of Greatness. I think it has to be Touch of Greatness. So Hodgson's Heroes, Fulham, Europa League, nearly men, but long journey men, Touch of Greatness. Stu, thank you so much for your time, insights, trivia tonight.
It's been a pleasure, guys. Thank you very much for inviting me to join you. It's been great.
Jamie, as ever, thanks for all your data insight there. Was there any data insight this time?
I don't think there was any. So I'll take your generous comment, but I don't think there was any. I think both you and Stuart were leading the data insight on this one. I think I was just supplementing it with stories of people punching windows.
I have to say, I think Stu picking up on Fulham scoring approximately 39 goals in every league season is possibly the greatest faction.
It really is. And I can tell you now, I've taken a note. I'm going to go away after this and I'm going to look at Roy Hodgson's Football League seasons to see how many goals he scored and against. And in next version's podcast, I'm going to bring that in to kind of give you an average in terms of where he is in goals scored per season.
That would be very interesting, actually. Because I reckon Palace are averaging around 39 at the moment, aren't they?
I reckon we're going to find...
I can't wait to start looking into it.
I can't wait. Brilliant.
So that's all we have time for this week. As a reminder, you can keep track of all the previous podcasts we've done and the upcoming podcasts we have, as well as some of our more debatable rankings at our revamped website. Jamie, what's the address again?
It is thegreatestteam.co. Thegreatestteam.co.
And if you've enjoyed the podcast, please follow us, please subscribe to make sure you get episodes automatically every Thursday. And until next time, we'll see you again then.